Company of Makers, podcast, talks, workshops.
We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power.
The task force, with all its power, is ready. Britain has gathered its might. It must set its course.
I'm not allowed to say how many planes joined the raid, but I counted them all out, and I counted them all back.
We're now between the two gun lines, and there's a right old artillery duel going on between them.
There is a white flag flying over Stanley. Very marvellous.
Welcome to Land, Sea and Air, Stories from the Armed Forces. In this series, we hear untold stories from the Falklands War, 40 years on. This is the story of the conflict, told by eight different people who were actually there.
Hi, Steve. In this Falklands series of podcasts we're doing for SAMA, one thing has become clear is that the entire operation would have been impossible without all of the merchant ships that were taken up from trade or requisitioned. So isn't it about time we heard the story of someone off one of those?
Yes, we're going to be talking to Keith Thompson, who was on board MV Norland, which, as we'll come on to, was a North Sea ferry turned, I think, South Atlantic ferry, as it turned out. But yeah, let's give this a listen. Keith, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast.
You're welcome. It's really nice to be back with you. Thank you. Yeah.
So before I hit the record button, you just told me that you're doing a few of these podcasts, so I think you're probably more expert than me. But what's your involvement with the Falklands? Because it's a bit different from some of our other guests.
Well, over the 10 years since I retired, I've been doing events to remember the Hull Task Force, which was nine merchant navy vessels what sailed from Hull, Norland, five trawlers and three tugs. Which did really good work down the South Atlantic, supporting the task force. We did incredible things together. And I think it's important that every year we celebrate by having a Saturday event and a Sunday service and parade. It's coming along really well. And with the 40th, what we're doing now is we've got the Royal Navy, the Armed Forces all involved. And going to have a terrific weekend in Hull. We've got a Royal Navy ship coming in. We've got all kinds of displays from the Royal Navy, Air Force and Army, Veterans Association, our wonderful cadets who we support. We're going to have a fly pass by Spitfire on the Saturday. We're involving the children because we want to do educational things for the children regarding the Falklands, the life in the Falklands. How their children cope after the conflict. Mm. So we're doing painting competitions for the children. We've got two big robots coming, wandering around, scaring the kids to death. And it's going to be a full-packed day. As I say, the Royal Navy ship's coming in. We don't know which one it is at the moment, but we're going to put visiting days on the ship. So it's all going on in Hull. The dates are the 18th and 19th. We've got Commodore Michael Clapp coming up with his wife, Sarah. Michael Clapp was in charge of all the rendezvous with all the ships in St. Carlos Bay, how we would go in formation, how we would offload our troops and where we would be during the air attacks. So it's a great celebration. It's important that we do it, and every year since, well, the last 10 years, we read everybody's name out at the church service. We give time to read everybody's name, the ship, the name, the unit, and, of course, the three Falkland Islands females, which was killed, unfortunately, by a shell which hit their house in Port Stanley. So every service, what we do, we take time to read out all their names because I think they deserve it. People forget, but we never forget in Hull. And with me being close ties with the 2nd Parachute Regiment, I think it's important that those lads who we took down south, we bonded with, we worked with, we drank with, and never came home. I think it's we should make sure every year their names are remembered. Not only for us, for the families as well.
I could not agree with you more, Keith. I think it's absolutely important that we do remember, and I think it's credit to you and your team, whoever you've roped in to help you, that you've done this. So I'd like to say well done. But you're not just somebody that's organising events. You were actually there, weren't you? Do you want to tell me a little bit about the story of, how a cross North Sea ferry, if I've got that right, I'm sure you'll correct me, became involved in a conflict 8,000 miles away?
Certainly, yes. What happened is, I'll start from the beginning. On the 16th of May, we've just returned from Rotterdam with 1,200 passengers, and there was a North Sea ferry running from Hull to Rotterdam, a merchant navy vessel, passenger ferry, and was on our way home. And our wireless operator, Brian Lavender, got a message from the MOD to contact the captain that the Norland would be requisitioned by the MOD to take the 2nd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, from Portsmouth to Ascension Islands. That was our brief. There was some MOD officials coming on board when we arrived in Hull on the 17th. That's when we was officially requisitioned. When these gentlemen came on board, the captain had a full meeting with all the officers and crew in the cafeteria with the MOD chaps. And the brief was, we'd have to do supply and cater for 800 troops plus our Royal Navy contingents and the crew. So it worked out 1,000 meals a day for breakfast, 1,000 for lunch, and 1,000 for dinner. So that was 3,000 meals a day we had to supply. We had to do it for 60 days. So we had to do it before we had to do all our logistic work on the 17th, 18th, and 19th because we was going to sail that night on the 19th to go around to Portsmouth to finish our helicopter decks, because we had to have two helicopter decks fitting. We had to have RAS machines and special radio operations units built on the ship. But our main task in the catering, because I was an assistant purser in the catering department, luckily enough, I'd been working with the catering department lads for over 10 years, because we picked up the Norland when she was brand new in 1973, and we've all worked together, so it was a good team to work with. So our logistics was get the accommodation ready, because when the paras came on board, they would have all their accommodation ready, so I could burgle or take away the bedroom staff and incorporate them into the restaurant and into the bars, so with extra staff to take the pressure off, it was going to be three, as I say, it's going to be huge. Luckily enough, we had a fantastic kid called George Rimmer. He was a chef of what I used to work with very well. And he said, well, I'll split my galley team into three. So that'd be a morning watch, afternoon watch, and a night watch. Same with the restaurant staff. We had a morning watch, afternoon watch. So it wasn't the task in hand was... We was used to do 1,200 passengers, so it wasn't impossible to do. We could do it, but we didn't put the stress on the people. So it was possible that we could do the job.
So, Keith, do you mind if I what on earth was going through your mind when you sort of thought, "Hang on, I didn't sign up for this. I'm you know, my job is to help passengers and feed passengers as across the North Sea." Oh, and by the way, you're taking two para down to Ascension Island. You'll be in Portsmouth in three. What on earth was going through your mind at this point?
How hell was going to do it? But how hell was going to do it? Because, as I say, it used to do 1,200 passengers. But when it come down to it, we had to make sure that the crew was okay working on these conditions and that. And Yeah, it was a huge task. First of all, our first job was to get 30 containers on board the ship to get all the supplies on board. We had to work with the stock suppliers and that. And it was a really hard task to do, but we did it. It's unbelievable. It was like a nightmare, and all of a sudden we did it. By the time we sailed from Portsmouth on the April the 26th, was already we welcomed Tuba on board, and from there it was a bit of a blur. Actually, you know, everything was working 16 hours a day to get this task done. That was even in Portsmouth, was getting up at 7 o'clock in the morning and not finishing well late in the night time. And that was everybody stuck in and got on with the job. And this made it easy for a lot of people because everybody was on the same wavelength. We had to get this job done. I think there was a carrot in the thingy because they said they'd give us a bit of a pay rise. So, when we get to Ascension, we'll get back on. We've got a belly door for a week. And that'll please the families. But, by the time we came to Portsmouth, it was all ready for sailing. All the accommodation was done. All the food was on board. The logistics for feeding them. Oh, my brief, really, when I spoke to one of the medics who came on board, he said, these men are fighting fit, and I don't want them to be ended landing on in Ascension with DMV. They've got to be fully fit and they've got to have a good menu. So we had to work out to make a very good menu for them. No expense was, you know, they had steaks and God knows what, chops and a really good diet get down to Ascension Island. We had a good team. And of course the bars as well, because what we had to do is we split the ship in three levels because we had to have officers on one area, NCOs in another area, and of course the Toms in another area. But that's how we split the bars up and the accommodation and the restaurant. So it really, after a couple of days when we left Portsmouth, everything clicked and we carried on with that.
So I'm guessing you also probably had quite a young team as well, did you? Or there were some youngsters on board that must have thought, crikey, this is all a bit unusual.
Yeah, me and the chef was the oldest. I was 32. George was about 34. And the rest of them was all in the 18th, 19th and 20s, young crew. And it was very enthusiastic as well. We've been together since 1973. And we all knew each other. And you ask anybody about the Norland, she was a family ship. When families came on board to go to Holland for the week or something like that, we looked after them and vice versa. It was a lovely family ship. And there was no, I'm an officer and you're a crew member. We all worked together. It was one of those ships. It was unbelievable how we all, fantastic, really. Yeah. And of course, they did look up to us older ones for a bit of experience. As I say, I was in Aden in 1967, so I had a bit of experience because I was doing a charter for the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. We got stuck in Aden because the conflict was still going on, and it was in Aden for 6 weeks. So I got used to Army life and Royal Navy life, you know, people coming on board, and I got into that. So when we was going down to Ascension, working with the Army, I had some kind of knowledge about it, you see. So I took on that role of like being guidance to everybody else in the catering department, how things would run.
So you're heading south, and of course your remit at this point is only to going to Ascension Island. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, our brief was the landing ships, the would take over the our the second parachute regiment, which would take them on to the Falkland Islands. But when we reached to Ascension Islands, it was understood we got the MOD on board and said, "You're carrying on." It's been decided by the powers that be that Norland is perfect for the job to take power on to San Carlos Bay and drop them in San Carlos Bay. So we said, what do we do now then? We said, well, you're going to sign 1850 articles, Royal Navy articles. You'd be all given a prisoner of war card if you get captured while you're in Stanley. You write a will. You've got time to write a letter to your family, but don't discuss anything regarding what's going to happen. And one phone call home, which we did. But the will was the hardest part. You don't expect to be writing the will. I'll just put, I'll leave everything to my wife. And in the letter, I just said, just carry on with the children and I'll be back safely and we can go from there. And please look after my garden because I love my roses and I don't want to come home when they're all dead. I had to do that to keep Jane working, take things off her mind that way. And I knew the two children would be worried, but I had a very strong wife. She came back from a Royal Navy family. Her father was in submarines, so she was that part of her life. She knew about being away at sea and what have you. It was hard. We had the opportunity, the captain had a meeting with us all and said, look, if anybody don't want to go forward, you can go home with flight home back to Brasenose. And all the crew said, no, we'll carry on. And that was when the good news came and said, well, you know, Nottingham Ferry said, you can go on a war bonus now. And said, yeah, there's more. Oh, great, we're going 100% wages. Bro, that's bloody marvellous. I hope this war lasts for about 4 or 5 years. And anyway, that's all I was worried about. But, yeah, so we carried on south. When we, the night before the landings, we had a message that Norland would go through first. It was ideal to go through first, but we didn't realise we was dispensable because the SAS found mines on the beachhead at Fanning Head, and there was wires going down and they suspected it would be a minefield. So they decided to take the old ships first. So Norland headed through, followed by HMS Plymouth, which was an old frigate, HMS Intrepid, which was just come out of the scrapyard, and HMS Fearless, which was ready for the Nakage Yard. So it was the first three ships through the minefield. During this time, the two paralads was all getting ready, and what we decided to do is we decided we'd make a meal for them. This was at 1 o'clock in the morning, but we decided let's get them some food and hot drinks down them and sandwiches. So the galley opened up, but we was doing bacon and egg sandwiches and sausage sandwiches and tea and coffee and anything what these lads wanted. And of course, the next day, yeah, all hell broke. It was the first time we'd ever experienced being shot at and bombed at. And we noticed quite a few of the Royal Navy ships was getting attacked, particularly HMS Ardent. And then we heard about HMS Sheffield in Coventry. And we thought this could be it for us. Anyway, on the morning of the Antelope was hit by a bomb. It was right next to her with the Fort Grange, and the Fort Grange had to move out because if the Antelope exploded, she had lots of ammunition on board the Fort Grange, so she moved out, but we stayed where we was, and we noticed she was in difficulty, the Antelope. So what we did, we dropped our lifeboats And we went across and we took all the crew, ship's crew, off the Antelope and took them back onto the Norland, where we cared for them, because a lot of them just got off the ship in their underpants and socks. And all the crew rallied round. We got all the clothing, spare clothing we had, and took them into a restaurant and looked after them. Made sure we had a Royal Navy medic on board, and he checked them all out. And we looked after them during the air raids. And then it was decided that we had to go pick up the Gurkhas from Gritvikan, South Georgia. So the Antelope ship's company stayed with us, because they would be transferred at Gritvikan onto the Kiwi to go home. So we sailed on the 24th of May to Lake Gritvikan. Us in the Cambria, we went down to Gritvikan, South Georgia, through all the ice fields. I remember seeing one iceberg which was 1.5 miles long by 0.5 mile wide. I couldn't believe the size of this thing. And we had no escorts. Anyway, when we got down to Gritvikan Haven, it was nice to see the whole tugs and the trawlers working away, taking troops off the QE2 to the Canberra, and to loading the Gurkhas off onto us. We said goodbye to the Antelope guys and wished them all well. They went off, and we got a huge respect from the Antelope guys, looking after them and taking them back to safety. Unfortunately, one member lost his arm, and only one person was killed, unfortunately. But the rest of the ship's company survived, and we're so pleased that we could get them onto the QE to go back home. Captain Tobin later said, if it weren't for the Norland and their respect to us, you know, we don't know what we'd have done. But we was there for them. A civilian ship, we was there for them, and we looked after them as best as we could.
So, Keith, obviously this isn't necessarily what you'd anticipated when you were back in Hull and first got the news. How did this affect yourself and the crew? Because obviously this is very real, but you've also done, you know, a good thing here in terms of helping people. How did you process all of that?
It was upsetting to see these lads, disheveled lads, you know, they've lost their ship. And of course, the Captain Tobin was devastated, but we just rallied round them. It was upsetting, but we didn't show our feelings, because we didn't want to upset them anymore. You know, when you lose a ship and you lose a colleague, that rendering. So we all mustered round them. And when we said goodbye to them, to board the trawlers to take them to the Gritvikan, everyone shook our hands, and it was a really bonded thing. And we're so pleased that we did it. And it's one of those things. We're just so pleased that they was going home and they'll get some medical attention better, and get home to their families. But there again, we had to get the Gurkhas on board. The Gurkhas was all coming on board, and we had to get a special gi off the Canberra, because we didn't have any gi, because with them being a certain religion, we had to do all the cooking in this gi. So we managed to get on board. The Gurkhas came on board, fantastic guys. They were really chuffed to be on the ferry, and we took them back to Ascension. But we hit really bad weather, and I've never seen bad weather like it in my life. It was about force 10, really bitterly cold, freezing weather, and the ship was moving around. Well, these guys are not used to being at sea. The majority of them, I think 90% of them, was just laid in the bunks being seasick. And but coming to lunchtime, they was there. They could be sick in the afternoon, and then lunch is on, ding dong, lunch is being set, and they was all there with the plates. I remember one for the English Gurkha officers, we put on steak and of pork loin. And the Gurkha said, "We want some of that." I said, and I said, "No, you can't. We're not allowed to give you or stuff them." He said, "Oh, we'll have some of that as well." Anyway, so there was having what the officer had. But it was great guys. It was only small, but it was lovely guys. And I remember when we took them, got ready to take them into San Carlos during the night to land them. They gave the captain a cookery, and was all given a cookery badge because it was an honour for us to take the Gurkhas into battle.
Mm.
So we landed them onto San Carlos beaches again, and they went into battle. And we was really chuffed that we'd been recognised by the Gurkhas for our feats, you know. So this story is getting bigger and bigger all the time because it's only a merchant navy ship, civilian ship, but we've been active doing like the Antelope, landing the Gurkhas, going for all these weather conditions. But we had more to come because all of a sudden prisoners of war was being captured and was held at Fox Bay. And our brief was once the conflict's completed and Stanley was taken, we would have to start being a prisoner of war ship. So we had a prisoner of war ship painted on the funnel, which is PRW, and we started taking the prisoner of war on, which was young conscripts. In total, we took our first run to Argentina was 1,500 conscripts. That was our first run, and we had the British Royal Medical Corps on board with us, and the Red Cross. They came on board as well because they wanted to make sure that they was given the right treatment. We said was a merchant navy ship, and we was a humanitarian ship. We would never harm these prisoners of war, although they tried to bomb us and sink us. When you're a prisoner of war, you act on the Geneva Convention and you treat them as human beings, which we did. And we looked after these guys from Port Stanley to Argentina, and we looked after them really well. But they was emancipated. A lot of them was emancipated. They hadn't been washed clean for a long while, and we haven't the facilities to give them showers and that. So what we did, we just put them in cabins where there was a sink and locked them up, and some of them was on the car deck. But we had to do a special meal for them. Breakfast was like a muesli meal. Lunch was like a soup. And then on the night time was like a really good stew. We couldn't build them up too much because it would make them ill. Because, as I said before, they was emancipated, didn't it? Some of these people had no food for about 2 or 3 weeks. They were sent to like places like Tumbledown, Two Sisters, and other places where it's remote. And they hadn't a clue about looking after themselves because, as I said, they'd just been taken out of colleges and schools, put on an aeroplane and dropped off.
Keith, that's really in contrast to everything that, you know, obviously when the Powers were disembarked, you were talking about what we're going to feed them and making sure they got the right food and all the rest of it. And now you're telling a completely different story from the other side. That's quite a contrast, isn't it?
It is quite a contrast. And all the crew volunteered to feed them. The ones in the cabins, we used to have unlocked the doors because we had a small contingency of Royal Marines. And a lot of the crew put the meals in the cabins. The ones on the car deck, we had like a canteen down there. And I know I got a bug off on some of the Argentinians working so close with them. And I was taken ill and I was taken off by helicopter. I had to go to Stanley Hospital to be put on a drip for about 3 days. But I wanted to get back to my ship because I was missing my ship, and they discharged me. And what I had was severe diarrhea and sickness through being in contact with these prisoners of war. But when we got into Argentina, it was nice to see them get off. But they was really brutally not very well looked after when they got to Argentina. I noticed that there was all these lorries down there, and they had no, there was a more or less kicked into these lorries and that. There was really no razzmatazz or anything. There was just quite silent. We were just seeing them all go off into these lorries, shut into these lorries and disappear. And I thought, that's some bloody country, that.
Mm.
And we did that twice because when we got back, we had another 2,500 waiting for us. So we took another 2,500 back to Argentina, and we did the same again. We fed them, made sure they was okay. We had a lot on the second round. We had a lot of them in the restaurant, laid on stretchers because they was wounded, and we looked after them as best as we can. And we formed a bond with some of them. I formed a bond with a college student. He was really educated. He was an engineering student. And he said they just came in and said, right, pack your bags, we're off. You're going to Argentina. He didn't want to go, but if he didn't go, he would have, his family would have been ashamed, you know. So, but he said, I didn't want to go, but I had to. He was on two sisters, and he said it was one of the worst things he ever experienced, and he was just thankfully that he was taken prisoner of war. It's a funny thing is war. You've got what the battle side, and then you've got the humanitarian side, and he was experiencing the humanitarian side, looking after these people who's been in conflict, didn't know what the hell to do, and he was going back home. It's a strange thing as well, isn't it, really? Mm. Yeah. But after the prison as well, we was given another notice. We thought we was going home to all the razzmatazz, but it said, no, Norland, you're our deal now. There's a South Atlantic ferry. So I said, what do you want us to do? He said, well, we've got the garrison to organise, so you've got to go to Ascension Highlands again and pick up the Queen's Own Highlanders, who was going to form the garrison. So we went to Ascension Highlands. We picked up all the stores, ammunition, and what we needed for the garrison, and we took them back to Port Stanley, offloaded them, and then was running up and down from Port Stanley to Ascension Highlands on a weekly basis. So it was a South Atlantic ferry then, doing a great job. We enjoyed it really because we was taking passengers, and it was just like a little jolly then. After the conflict, it was nice sunny weather. Everybody was getting a suntan. People was having breaks. But was missing home as well and was thinking, when the hell are we going to get home? Because it was coming up to Christmas time this time. But the Norland carried on her duties, and then it was decided that we would be released. We'd done our work, and we could sail home. We finally got home into Hull on the 1st of February, 1983.
Wow.
The Norland, we was at sea. Our sea days was 282 days, and our log was 66,000 miles, 325 miles. So that's how many miles we travelled, 66,000 miles. She was a workhorse in Holland, and the crew deserved the credit. And this is why every year I do these services and remembrance services, not only for the whole task force, but for the 2nd Parachute Regiment that we served with, and the HMS Antelope. We remember them as well, with our close contacts with them. And that's our story, really.
So, Keith, it's I think what's quite different about your story is the amount of time you were down there after it was all over, you know, and, you know, getting to that point wasn't exactly straightforward. So I think this idea that there were still active ships, obviously a garrison brought down, as you pointed out. So it's quite remarkable, isn't it, that it was, wasn't until 1983. When you told me this the first time, I was surprised. So it's, I think it's important that we talk about that because it's you know, there's a big effort that's gone into this. But then there's also, you know, the consequences and fallout of the war.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah, as I say, she was a marvellous workhorse, and all the crew was a fantastic, did fantastic jobs. Well, it's in maritime history. The Norland is in maritime history, what she did down south. I know the Canberra, she did a lot of work down there, but Canberra came home a long time before us. And we thought it was forgotten about, actually. But we had a fantastic welcome when we came home. Just actually fantastic to see all the families and that on the quayside and that, which is brilliant. No, we're proud. You ask any of the crew members or any of the officers, we're proud of what we did. It's in history now. And I think if we had an Norland back, we would certainly do again if we was asked to do it again, but only on the Norland. I managed to get the Norland's bell, actually, before she was scrapped in the battle on us from DP World. And I've done a memorial at the Hull Minster dedicated to the Hull Task Force. And that's at the Minster now, and with the Norland bell, the original Norland bell. And each service, we lay wreaths at the memorial for the parachute regiment and those who lost their lives.
I can really hear the pride in your voice, and I think you know that's a really good thing. And I can tell also how important it is to you that you continue to commemorate these things. These activity in the service. I think we started talking, didn't we, about what's happening in Hull. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about this? And, you know, if any of our listeners are in that neck of the woods, what can they do to come along? Is that something they can do?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's open to everybody. We have an opening. Well, on the Friday, the Royal Navy is coming down with all their display teams. We've got a dive team that's bringing a tank. We've got two helicopters being offloaded. I've just organised the cranes to get them in sight. We've got a Royal Navy ship coming in, which is going to be open to visitors. I don't know which one it is yet, but I'm working with the APB docks and the tug services. When we find out, we'll do all the logistics to welcome it into Hull, and that'll be open to the public. So the main dates is the 18th of June and the 19th of June. So on the 18th of June is all the exhibitions, displays by the Armed Forces, the Veterans Associations and our wonderful cadets. There's children's events, which is painting competitions, drawing competitions about the Falklands. We've got two robots wandering around, scaring everybody. We've got a bus coming, which is decorated by our local bus company, dedicated to the whole task force, and that's going to run for 3 years with all the decorations on the bus. I've managed to raise the money for a Falklands bench dedicated to the whole task force, and a special commemoration plaque on it for Roy Gibson. Now, Roy Gibson was one of the stewards who played music for the paras as we went down south, and the family are going to be there to unveil the bench. The bench is going to be situated on the pier looking out to sea, and that's for the people of Hull. They sit on the bench and memorise. It's going to have two plaques on it, one plaque for all the ships what sail from Hull, and of course one to Roy Wendy Gibson. That's going to be unveiled on a Saturday. The cadets are going to do drum corps events, music. We've got a fly pass by Spitfire on a Saturday afternoon, which is going to be good. And then, of course, on the Sunday, we've got a church service at the Hull Minster. Everybody's invited. That's on the 19th, 1:30 for 2 p.m. start. And I've managed to get the Royal Marines Band from down south to come up and lead the parade. The parade will be right through the city centre with all the veterans and the armed forces to the Hull Cenotaph, where we will lay wreaths and have a small commemorative service. Then after that, I'll take a few tablets and a few bottles of rum, and I think that'll be it then until next year. They've already said to me, in 2024, we're all coming to Hull. Can you do it again? I said, well, let's get this one up first.
So, well done you. I mean, you're obviously putting a lot of effort into this, but I think also you did mention to me that when you've been doing this for about 10 years, and, you know, the number of people that come to this has increased quite a lot, hasn't it? I think you said there was just under 600 people last time that you did this. So hoping for big things this time, yeah?
Yeah, well, we're expecting... Well, the council and the Humbertown Police have expected 15,000 footfall for this weekend. Yeah. When I first started 10 years ago, my church service, what I had, to do the memorial, dedication of the memorial, we had 36 people there. 2019, before the COVID, we had 590 people there, and it's getting bigger and bigger each time. So we're getting the message out at last. And of course, I've formed a charity now. I'm chairman of a charity called Norland Crew, and what we do is we get donations and grants, and every penny is spent on veterans. We have a therapy centre in Hull, which we support, and we take veterans out on days. You know, we do events for the widows as well. So we're doing quite a lot of work in Hull what we do for our charity.
Well done. That's really, really important. I tell you, if you can, once we finish this, if you can send me any links and information about this by email, we can give that a plug for you as well, because I think it's important that we do that and then we talk about this. So I just wanted to ask you one question. You started this about 10 years ago. What inspired you to do that, to actually get involved in the commemorations?
I was fed up with people saying, what did Hull do? And nobody knew about the tugs or the trawlers, and very little known about the Norland. And with my work now, everybody knows about the tugs and the trawlers, and used to call them the forgotten ships. Mm. And I thought, no, they can't be forgotten. And I started this campaign, and then I started doing events, and it's got bigger and bigger and bigger, and everybody knows about the whole task force now, which I'm really pleased now. A lot of people said to me, you've left a good legacy, and I'm so pleased I have left a good legacy, and I hope it'll carry on after I've gone. Proof is in the pudding, you know, from 36 people to nearly 600 people, and God knows how many this year. It's really worked. It's been hard, and I must admit, I've got a long-suffering wife who's, we've had to cancel things and that due to meetings and what have you, but, you know, I've had a great support from Jane, and all credit to her.
Couldn't do it without her, could you?
No, I couldn't. No.
No.
Particularly when the computer freezes and I chuck it in the garden, she brings it back in again. I'm on my computer about 4 or 5 hours a day on these events, because people are coming in and saying, we've got the logistics and people who want to bring items, and I'm working with the Hull City Council at the moment. For all the barriers and God knows what. So hard work, but at the end of the day, it's fantastic when it all comes off.
Yeah, I did see your wife very briefly as the chief IT officer setting up this Zoom call. So do say hello again to her for me. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for taking the time to this. And more importantly, thank you for all the effort that you're putting in for other people. I think it's commendable, great work, well done.
Yeah, well, I have been recognised. The Metz Navy Association's recommended for a Meritorious Medal, which is the highest medal you can get in the Metz Navy. And I went to Trinity House in London, and it was presented by the Princess Royal. So I've got what they call the Metz Navy Meritorious Medal for all my work I've done. So it has been recognised.
Good. Well deserved, I'd say. Well deserved. And I just say thank you on behalf of all those people that you support. You. I think it's really important you do that and keep up the good work.
Yeah, I will do, yeah. I've got some young lads with me now, and if I pop the clogs, they can carry on.
Well, you can't do that yet. You've got to do until 2024, apparently. But anyway, yeah, you can decide that after you've had your bottle of rum. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the interview. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Now, before Stephen might look back at the interview we've just heard, you may be interested to know that here at Company of Makers, we've got loads of online activities for veterans to get involved in. As well as this podcast, we've got online talks with inspiring guests, and we've got workshops where you can learn something new and meet like-minded people from the forces. To find out more, sign up for our newsletter and we'll send all the latest updates direct to your inbox. Just head over to companyofmakers.com/newsletter. Now back to Steve and Mike.
So that's a very different perspective on the Falklands War, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, these are as much educational as fascinating in terms of I learn something every time I listen to one of these, or learn several things, and there were certainly much about this. I had no idea that Hull was requisitioned more vessels than any other port in the UK for the Falklands conflict.
No, neither did I. And also, you may recall that when we chatted, or I chatted to Adrian Bell, he talked about very briefly about his times in the Falklands, and he was on board a trawler. And as you know, I know everything about what the Royal Navy gets up to. And I was thinking, what on earth does the Royal Navy need a trawler for? Well, as it turns out, it's something to do with minesweeping, Mike.
Yeah, well, they're very adept at, you know, living in the sort of waters that the South Atlantic presented at that time of year. So they would have been, and they're largely made of wood as well, which is also useful when it comes down to minesweeping. So actually, it's quite a lot of lateral thinking on the MOD's part.
You live and learn, don't you?
You certainly do. Anyway, I mean, there's lots to pick from this discussion, and really fascinating account of, you know, the many lives that the Norlan lived. She was relatively new when she was taken up for train or requisitioned, and their sort of, you know, what they've been used to as a North Sea ferry was taking 1,000-1,200 passengers across the North Sea over a day or so. So the idea of sailing 8,000 miles away and carrying 1,000 troops, or as it turned out later, prisoners of war, and feeding them for weeks on end, not a day, must have been an extraordinary challenge logistically for the catering team.
Yeah, and I'm sure Tuparo are quite a hungry bunch as well.
I'm sure Tuparo were very hungry, although it sounds like that Keith looked after them very well. He talked about steaks and the importance. I mean, I think we all know the importance of a good diet and nutrition and food on the morale of forces. And if you make sure that your own armies, navies, etc., are well fed, they're going to fight better than if they're malnourished, as we now know that the Argentinian defenders of the Falkland Islands were occupiers, not defenders.
Yeah, an army marches on its stomach, I believe.
That's Napoleonism, I think. Yes, you're absolutely right. Anyway, so you know, imagine the amount of sausages they had to order for 800 paras who had a 3 to 3 week sort of trip down to the South Atlantic. And needed, you know, to maintain their, you know, protein and physical fitness en route. That the logistics behind that would have been extraordinary, given that, you know, largely they could have restocked every day when they were doing their North Sea operation.
Yeah, I wasn't really expecting you to say that, but I think is there a competition here? Guess how many sausages Tuparo ate. I don't know what the prize would be. Probably some sausages, of course.
No, well, I think we all should invite Canberra and QE2 to join the competition and see whether the Royal Marines or 5th Brigade ate more sausages. Who ate the most sausages? There's a question for everyone. Who could tell me what was the biggest number of sausages eaten in any of the ships taken up for trade?
Well, that's quite a challenge.
So they are happily doing their business. No thought that this distraction down in the South Atlantic, 8,000 miles away, might involve them, until suddenly they get called in and told, we've been taken up from trade, we've been requisitioned, and we're about to sail to the Ascension Islands carrying troops, carrying paratroopers. And that's what they were initially told, was they're going to go to Ascension, which, of course, is still relatively safe waters, and got told to prepare for that. And I think that, that was all about refitting it for a different customer, resupplying it for the trip, and then get going. So they got told on the 16th of April, so that was about 14 days after the invasion, and they sailed from Portsmouth on the 26th of April. So pretty quick turnaround, actually, armed with their paratroopers, and on they went to Ascension.
Quick turnaround. That's the story, isn't it, with all of this, the speed at which this was done. Yes, so they set off for Ascension with their newly fitted helicopter deck.
Yes, yes. Which would have been very strange to them, I'm sure. But anyway, and of course, as we now know, they got to Ascension and were told to go further south. They were told to continue. They were given the option by the captain that if they didn't want to continue into what was effectively going to be a war zone, that they could return home with they wanted volunteers. And I think it just shows the resilience of the British merchant marine seamen, that they all volunteered. I think they volunteered in every single vessel that was taken up from trade to get stuck in, which is just shows you how united the whole of the nation was behind this effort to, not let aggressive bullying win.
Indeed. Did he say there were ladies on board as part of the crew?
Well, there would have been. I mean, North Sea Ferry would have had female officers, female stewards, as part of the North Sea operation. And there's no reason why they shouldn't have been asked to continue doing the same valuable service they were anyway. I mean, they would have been given the option like everyone else, and they all volunteered, so.
Which is obviously all credit to them. But this is obviously at a time when women didn't go to sea in the Royal Navy, of course, and they're all heading off to a combat zone.
That's exactly right. So actually, you're right. There weren't any women serving at sea in ships and submarines then. Obviously, that's changed now. So the only women at sea were in the merchant ships.
Indeed.
So what happened then? They proceeded south and were there part of the... they then discovered that she was a particularly good vessel for ferrying troops ashore. The Navy has dedicated vessels for this, the amphibious squadron. In those days, it was Fearless and Intrepid, some landing ship logistics like Sir Galahad. We've spoken about that before. But not many of them. And to get the number of troops ashore that was required to have critical mass to retake the islands and evict the occupiers, needed ships like the Norland to be able to do landings as well. And I think she did it really well. So she adapted to a role that she never dreamed of only a few weeks beforehand.
I think the whole armed forces adapted to a role they didn't dream of, because this wasn't a conflict anybody expected.
Well, it wasn't a conflict that the 1991 Defence Review envisaged. In fact, that Defence Review said this sort of scenario was quite unlikely, which of course may have given the Argentinian succour to even contemplate it in the first place. But it's lucky that the Defence Review didn't happen any earlier, because we may have lost some of the capabilities needed to take the islands had there been a greater gap between the Defence Review and the actual invasion.
Yeah, that was the 81 Defence Review, not the 91 Defence Review, I assume.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of Defence Reviews, but it was the known as the Knot Defence Review in 1981. And effectively, we were in the process of selling off our carriers, I think Australia was interested in the new Invincible class. We were going to reduce the surface fleet by a large degree, half, I think. And the only, I think, the Royal Marines were under Damocles' sword, and I think only the Submariners were, because the Cold War was still very much ever-present in those days, were the only bit that was preserved of the naval forces. So
Gary Steele mentioned this from Tupara, didn't he? So he said, what did the Falklands do for Tupara and probably continued their existence? Because as you say, there were many, many aspects of the armed forces that were likely for the chop. I'm sure Mr. Knott was winning the popularity competition.
Yeah, well, I won't comment too much on that if you don't mind, but I think you know what most of us feel about that.
And
I think, like the Tuparas, I think the Falklands very much saved the Navy to some extent, and the Royal Marines, because it just showed how vital the capabilities that were due to be axed were still required, and particularly what I call floating runways, the ability to launch air from the sea to defend, territories that are not, thousands of miles away is something that I think a lesson that we've learned.
Yeah, and we've only just had that capability reinstated as well.
Yeah, properly. Yeah, thank goodness though. So he gives a really vivid description about being in Bomb Alley, all hell loose, air attacks, and of course another poignant. You managed to unearth a lot of quite sobering reflections, and I think the one in this discussion was about being near to Antelope, HMS Antelope, Type 21 frigate, when she got hit, and the need to rescue the ship's company from them, many of whom he said were escaping in their underwear, and clothe them and feed them and make them feel, reassured. Luckily, there wasn't a large loss of life in Antelope. I think sadly, one person lost his life, and one person was badly injured, but they didn't have the same number of deaths that, say, like the Coventry had, thankfully. But there she was as a rescue ship, watching it all happen in front of her, which must have been extraordinary. And they formed a very close bond with the Antelope Ships Company as well, as they did Tupara.
Yeah, I think also it's that experience which, of course, they wouldn't have trained for, as we've talked about before with the Merchant Navy. But also, Keith goes on, I think, more recently, doesn't he, to recognise those people that served and their experiences.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Then their third set of visitors, they seem to have had an awful wide range, a diverse range of customers, were the Gurkhas. They talked about the Gurkhas coming aboard. And I don't know if you've ever met any Gurkhas, Steve, but they're extraordinary, impressive men. I think they are all men, apart from Joanna Lumley, who seems to be an honorary Gurkha. And I think their spirit, which everyone knows about the Gurkha spirit, but I think their spirit was the fact that, not being used to being at sea, they were actually quite seasick, except when mealtimes came along, when they all got up. I thought that was very funny.
Yeah, Nepal's a little bit landlocked, isn't it, in the Himalayas? You don't get many ships there.
Not many ships in Nepal, you're right. So the Gurkhas were on board them for a while, and then actually, once we got to surrender time, she was then converted into a prisoner of warship, and she made two trips back to the Argentinian mainland, first with 1,500 prisoners of war and second with 2,500. And I was interested in his observations about how emancipated they were. So we talked about the importance of diet on the morale of fighting spirit and things like that. Clearly, some of them hadn't fed properly for days and weeks, and they therefore had to be quite careful about how much food they gave them in order not to overdo it, because they could have easily actually created a bigger problem by overfeeding them.
Yeah, it is remarkable that you'd expect people to fight in such conditions.
Yeah, well, then don't invade islands that aren't yours in the first place, is what I say, you know. He talked about getting to know a college student as part of one of the prisoners of wars on the second trip, and the sort of, you know, bafflement about being told to go, not wanting to go, not knowing why they were going, things like that. And I guess that was quite common amongst the Argentinian conscripts.
Mm.
So you thought that was it then. You'd have thought, okay, so back to Portsmouth or Hull with lots of those V showers of water, water cannons in Vs, you know, with lots of troop, lots of people cheering on. But no, she's a ferry. And they needed a ferry to operate in the South Atlantic. And who better than a North Seas ferry? So she then spent the next 6 months running between Ascension and the Falkland Islands, basically setting up and supplying the garrison that was going to be based there as a permanent force in the Falklands to come. So she spent an awful long time at sea, Steve.
She did indeed. And also, I think, you know, with all the headlines when most of the fleet returned, I mean, she, as you've already said, she was there a lot longer. And obviously there were many other ships and assets that were also still deployed down there long after the official welcome home.
Yeah, indeed. And I think he mentioned 282 days at sea, which is, you know, extraordinary. 66,000 miles steamed. And they were in the thick of it for much of it as well. So, you know, they weren't a part player. They were right in the thick of it, you know. And they eventually got back to Hull, to a Hull welcome, which I'm sure would have been brilliant, on the 1st of February, 83.
Remarkable, isn't it?
What's also remarkable is that, you know, he's now set up this events company that runs the sort of Falklands Memorial weekend in Hull every year. I think he's been doing it for 10 years. Started off with 36 and they're anticipating 15,000 this June, he said. And he's taken upon that himself to do that. So I think he said the catalyst was when someone said, well, what has Hull ever done for the Romans or for the war? And he was determined to know that actually she did an awful lot. And we can see that, can't we? Not just the Norland, but all those trawlers that were taken up for trade and things like that. I mean, Hull did its bit, didn't it?
Yeah, it made a massive contribution and it's not to be underplayed. And I can understand why he would want that commemorated.
So I think if any of the listeners are in the northeast and can make their way to Hull for the 18th or 19th of June, I think they're in for a treat. I think Keith has got some fantastic experiences laid on for you, depending on for all ages and all tastes, and including the single main event, which is the dedication at Hull Minster, where they read out the names of the 258 people who lost their lives on our side, which must be again another sobering moment. But if you can, I think find your way to Hull on the 18th and 19th of June this year, I think you're in for a treat.
Yeah, I agree. But I also like his passion for getting young people involved and getting young people to learn about their history.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic. I'd like to complete this discussion we're having by reiterating the observation at the start, which is actually we took up something like 47 ships from trade for the Falklands conflict, and there was no way we could have done it without the merchant navy, the various elements of the merchant navy, like ships like the Norland and the Canberra and the Q2, etc., Uganda. But there were 47 of them. We couldn't have done it without... and they were all volunteers as well. They were all not trained to do this. Yet they all volunteered. They all did a superb job. And the nation needs to remember its merchant navy was there for it when it mattered.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It's a job well done. Thanks for that, Mike. That's been fascinating insight to the merchant navy. So, I mean, I learned an awful lot there. But thank you.
You're welcome, Steve. Hi, it's Mike here again. So just to let you know, this podcast accompanies the stunning Falklands 40th commemorative book produced by theveteran.uk on behalf of the South Atlantic Medal Association, SAMA 82. And we'd like to say a really big thank you to both our funders for making this possible, namely theveteran.uk and SAMA. And if you'd like to buy a copy of the book, then please head to either the veteran.uk website or sama82.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
Before we finish, we'd love to hear from you. So if you've got any thoughts, suggestions, or even a bit of banter, just email us at podcast@companyofmakers.com. You never know, you might even get a mention. And don't forget to hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you. This podcast was produced by Rachel Owen, hosted by Mike Davis Marks, and me, recorded and edited by yours truly.
Company of Makers, podcast talks, workshops.